We'll call the Health and Human Services meeting to order for today. First of all, we did some introductions last week, but one person I overlooked, or people I overlooked, are pages. Maybe it would be worthwhile if you just want to stand up and introduce yourself briefly. Okay. All right, thank you. And I think there's a few other members who weren't here last time, couldn't be here. If you just want to introduce yourself, I think Jim, probably.
Yeah, I'm Jim.
Sorry, Representative Abeles. You want to just say where you're from, I guess.
Oh, from Anoka, in God's country.
So, you're here.
Laura Broad, I represent District 25A, which is Le Sueur County, part of Sibley, and a little piece of Scott.
Representative Bruce Anderson, represent Wright County, cities of Buffalo, Monticello, Clearwater, and Maple Lake.
Chair Huntley, you want to?
I have a cap number. Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Huntley. I'm from the city of Duluth, the eastern part of the city,
Okay, so thank you. And I also think Dan was not here.
Dan Pollock, DFL House Research.
Oh, where is he? Oh, here we go. I didn't even see it, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Emmer. I represent the part of Wright County that Representative Anderson does not represent, which is just a suburb of God's country, I guess.
Very good. All right. Next, why don't we just approve the extensive minutes here from last meeting? Representative Norton, do you want to move the minutes?
I'm Representative.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Minutes are adopted. Then, I did want to identify, I don't know if, Representative Tao is here. We have appointees to the licensure subcommittee. Which Representative Tao is chair of. It'll be Aaron Murphy, Kim Norton, Julie Bunn, Patty Fritz, Jim Abler, Representative Finstad, and Representative Hamilton. All right. And I don't think we need any more action on that. So, that's it. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Fritz.
Okay, we're going to call up House File 1. Representative Paul Thiessen. Give you a minute. You identify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I move House File 1. I guess we'll just move it at this point.
Okay.
To get it for us.
All right. And begin.
Thank you. Well, House File 1 is the Children's Health Security Act, and I guess kind of as a preliminary matter, Minnesotans, I think, generally agree, we all agree probably, that Minnesota children should have access to a doctor and to quality medical care. And, you know, I think it's an economic and a social and kind of a moral imperative that we move in that direction. You know, we have about 68,000 kids in Minnesota that are lacking in health coverage. 80% of those are in families where one or both parents work. A lot of them live outside of our metro area. I think more than the majority live outside of our metro area. So this is really a statewide issue and an issue that's not only kind of this imperative that we move on, but it's also something that, as a practical matter, and I think our state, as much as any other state, can accomplish meaningful coverage for all kids. It's an achievable goal, and that's kind of my basic premise that I'm operating under. House File 1, which is the bill before us today, is one practical path, I think, toward achieving that goal. There's other paths, and I'll be the first to admit that there'd be other paths to achieve that goal as well. And that's kind of one of the reasons, just to clarify, we're going to only be taking testimony today. We're not going to be taking amendments and acting on the bill, because I think this is a subject that is worth a full debate and discussion. And so we want to kind of take public testimony, talk it through, get questions answered, and then, you know, in a few weeks, we'll bring it back and maybe we can have a more informed discussion and other alternatives on the table if that's the direction. And in addition to that, I hope in the course of the next couple of weeks we can also move in the direction of doing tying this to some cost controls and other reforms in healthcare, so that we're both expanding our access. And there are a lot of reforms actually in this bill, I think, that will make things much more efficient and effective. But to kind of put it in a little broader context. So what I'm going to do today briefly is just to kind of explain some of the fundamental premises of the bill and then walk it through, and then we'll have some public testimony to talk about what's in the bill. It's really two ideas that are motivating this piece of legislation. The first is that the primary reason, I think we all know this, that children don't have meaningful health insurance or health coverage is that we've erected some barriers to coverage. And this is on the public program side. Three of the four uninsured kids in Minnesota are actually eligible for public programs. And so one of the insights that we're working on is that, you know, we as a legislature have promised that we're going to provide coverage to these kids. But on the other hand, we've erected a system that kind of undermines that promise. And so one of the things that this bill does is get at some of those barriers. We have application forms that are, 20-plus pages, grown from 4 pages in the past. We have the complexity of 2 systems in Minnesota cover, or more, to cover kids, the MA, Minnesota Care. One of the things this bill does, as we'll talk about, is it merges that into a single comprehensive program for kids. We have rules that, for instance, disallow coverage if an employer offers to pay for 50% of a person's dependent care health premium. But today, that 50%, unlike when Minnesota Care was passed, you know, a decade or more ago, that 50% is becoming more and more, less and less affordable for many Minnesota families to actually afford to pay. So one of the goals of the Children's Health Security Act is to break down those barriers, and we'll talk about that more in detail as I walk through the bill. The second reason, or the second kind of motivating idea here, is that our employer-based system of coverage, health insurance coverage, is under great stress in Minnesota and across the country, really. Employers are continuing, and for understandable economic reasons, to drop health care coverage. And that's particularly true among the smallest firms, under 10. Only 34% of companies under 10 employees offer health insurance to their employees. In addition to kind of the employer stresses, there's changing in the nature of employment on the other side. People are changing jobs more often, and so there's issues of turnover and kind of portability. People are more often working as independent contractors or part-time, where they don't have access to employer-based benefits. And so all these things together come to the conclusion that there's a lot of stress in the system we currently have, and it's kind of failing us, is the bottom line. So one of the fundamental ideas captured in House File 1 is that a child's access to a doctor shouldn't turn on whether their parent is employed or where their parent is employed or the type of coverage offered by the parent's employer. It should be the child's access to health care should be independent of those factors, and that's one of the goals we're moving on. I have some information on why children's coverage is so critical that I'll skip over here briefly, but only to say that we know, and the research tells us, that health care outcomes, public health outcomes, you know, infectious diseases and those types of things, performance in school, emotional stability of families, all these things are tied to whether a child has access to health care. And having access to health care improves all of those indicators. And so it's kind of a broader issue than just about healthcare. It's a really kind of a societal issue and an investment we make that's going to pay off in a wide variety of ways if we can get to our goal. So just to walk through the bill briefly, it sets up a children's health security program. As I mentioned, it merges MA and Minnesota Care into a single seamless program. And that's in the first sections of the bill. Section 5 deals with eligibility. And what it says is that permanent residents up to age 19 or 25, if you're still in school and still a dependent, would have access to this health coverage. And that's just to mirror kind of the private health insurance market. That's kind of how private health insurance goes. If you're in school and you're over 19, you still have access to your parents' health insurance, typically. Initially, we are the income eligibility, and that's the key eligibility under this bill, is at 300% of poverty. It's generally 275, I believe, today. So there is a slight expansion in phase one about income levels of who's covered. And then, in addition to that, there's a task force established, and that's at the end of the bill, and I can get to that toward the end here, to consider how are we going to move to get coverage for everybody beyond 300% of poverty. And it could be an expansion of the program we're adopting in the first phase. It could be something else. But we're going to kind of set that aside and deal with that for the next in the next biennium. One important thing I want to, important point I want to stress is this is all voluntary. So a family does not have to use this program. They can buy separate insurance. Employers can continue to offer dependent care coverage if they so choose. So this is a voluntary program. No one's forced into this. Section 6 talks about coverage, and it's the benefit levels we have today. There's really no changes there. Section 7 talks about premiums and cost sharing, and under this bill, as it's drafted, there are no premiums or cost sharing involved for kids. Parents will still have to pay the premiums if they have access to Minnesota Care. And we'll, this merits a little bit of discussion. I think there'll be more as the public testimony comes in. But currently, premiums are close to 10% of a family's income in Minnesota Care, typically, which is a lot. And it's the top-cited reason, aside from finding other insurance, for people leaving Minnesota Care. So premiums really are having an effect on this issue of who can access our public programs. And I hope we have some more discussion about this as some of the public testifiers come forward. But I think this is really an important part of the bill, and it also works in connection with the next section, which is Section 8, talking about how you become eligible. We're making access to this children's program, it's presumptive eligibility. So a provider, if you show up at the doctor's office, that provider can do a rough screening, which is really going to just be about income, and can make you eligible, then and treat you and get reimbursed. That's then submitted to the Department of Human Services, and they can make the eligibility determination later for permanent status, but someone who shows up the doctor actually is insured immediately. So, and this is something we had in Minnesota Care originally and was changed. And we also passive renewal, which means that after the end of 1 year period, which is going to be the renewal period for these children's programs, the department will send out a sheet to you saying, "Are you still qualified? If you don't respond, you'll continue to be renewed." So you'll stay in the program unless you indicate to the department that your income basically has gone above 300% of poverty. And one thing that's really important to remember with regard to kind of these enrollment items, there's studies out there that have shown that by making enrollment presumptive and more seamless, the cost to the state of the eligibility function is reduced by up to 40%. So there's actually some cost savings built in to doing it this way. Let's see. Section 9 just talks about how we're going to deliver the services, and it's going to kind of be the same as we're doing it now. There's contracting with health programs, waiver disability programs remain fee for service, and clients, just as it is now, would be able to choose the plan that they think is most appropriate for them. There's some assistance and outreach provisions in Section 11. Some monitoring and accountability provisions in Section 12, which I think are really important. If we're going to move forward with this, we want to make sure that we're getting the quality services delivered to kids in Minnesota that we're expecting. And then there's some information about an implementation plan that will come back from the Department of Human Services at the end of this year that will kind of flesh out the proposal, the details of the proposal, how they intend to implement it. And finally, there's this task force established for the second phase, which is to cover families who make more than 300% of poverty. And again, that's not defined in the bill. It's going to be left to this group to figure out the best way to accomplish that. I also think I should mention some things that are not in the language, but that may be of interest to the committee. This program won't include a four-month waiting period that we currently have in Minnesota Care. This program won't have the rule that you're not eligible if your employer provides 50% coverage. So all those kind of pieces that are in Minnesota Care that are some barriers to eligibility aren't included, even though they don't show up in the bill. They won't be part of the program going forward. So that's the overview of the bill and the policy issues kind of related to the bill. And I'm happy to stand for questions kind of related to the text of the bill and how some of the provisions may work. It may be worthwhile to wait on some of the other larger policy issues till we get some public testimony, because some of those questions may be answered. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Have questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. Just an easy one here, and I know there's more discussion to come. Could you comment on Section 10, the provider rates? Will they kind of mirror the issue system based upon Minnesota Care rates, kind of, or just in that ballpark? Or are they more geared toward commercial rates?
Madam Chair and Representative Abel, that's a very good question. I think how it is conceived of here is that it will be contracted for, and I have heard from providers, that there is some concern, particularly if we go to a program where there's more people in public programs, that there's concerns about provider rates, and that is something that we can talk about more. The details aren't in the bill and aren't intended to be, but I know that that's a concern, because there is some cross subsidy going on, and so that's an issue. Thank you.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, I'm sure that you can provide me some information on this going forward, too, but I was looking at page 3, section 5, subdivision 3, part D, first sentence, and it talks about the temporary nature of, that the children are not losing eligibility because they're temporarily absent, things along those lines. In tax committee this morning, we were actually talking about the temporary sales tax increase that we had that has now lasted for 15 years. And so I just wanted to maybe have you at some point try to hone in a little bit on more for me on what temporary actually means, and if there's a definition somewhere.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Broad. And I think the temporary here is a little bit different from the discussion you probably had in taxes. This isn't intended as a temporary provision. This is more to get at circumstances where, if a child has parents living in two different states and, for the summer, for a couple months in the summer, goes to live with his dad in Arizona, he wouldn't lose eligibility, if there's an intent to return to Minnesota and keep Minnesota as a permanent resident. That's my understanding of what this provision is getting at, and I think that probably will be something, flesh needs to be put on those bones, that will be part of the Department of Human Services coming back at the end of this year. But that's what is intended there.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, just so I can understand the process first, because we have these new temporary rules put in place with respect to how committees work. You've got this proposal that you're bringing up today that you want to have a discussion about, some questions, and then I'm not clear. Where is it going to go, and are we ensured that it's coming back here?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we're going to probably hear the bill again on February 1st or sometime in that range. We're just going to lay it on the table at the end of today. It's going to stay in our committee. Yeah. It didn't seem fair to me to force amendments and to force a vote until we kind of got a full hearing of what's in the bill. That's the only reason that I'm proceeding this way.
Madam Chair? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Thiessen, and I think that's a wonderful approach. With that in mind, I have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask you. A couple have to do with definitions or terms that you've used in this proposal. And the other one has to do with a timing issue. So why don't I start with a timing issue? It appears from my reading of House File 1, you're creating some kind of study group to look at how this would be applied, and yet the study group's work is not actually done until after you've implemented the program. How is that supposed to work?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Everett. There's two phases to the bill. One is for people under 300% of poverty, and I think the easiest place just in terms of language is to look at Section 5, Subdivision 2, which is language that needs to be worked on a little bit, but the idea here is that this will actually, for people under 300, for families under 300% of poverty, this will be the plan. This will be how we cover kids under 300% of poverty. For families who make more than 300% of poverty, there's a task force set up that will be reporting back to us to talk about what are our options to making sure that families with, and there are some families that have kids that are uninsured over 300% of poverty, and there's others that have insurance but maybe not, you know, we may want to consider whether that's the proper way to, whether our current system is the proper way to do it. That's what the task force will be looking for. So I think you really need to look at it in two phases. So basically the timing is this. You know, assuming this bill would be passed this year, that it doesn't go into effect for phase one until July of 2008. At the end of this year, the end of 2007, the department will come back to us with language that they think they need to implement it, and that would be put into place next year before July 1st of 2008. Phase two is intended to start July 1st of 2010, which leaves a whole additional biennium. This task force will report back by the end of 2009, I believe, is the timing. So there's two, that's how that timing works.
Representative Emmer.
Well, thank you. Then I guess since you referenced it, Section 5, if you look at that Subdivision 2 that you referenced, the question I've got, and maybe this is what kind of took me off task, is you've got Subdivision 2A, which references what you've called your first tier, or your first, phase. And then you've got B, which is what you reference as your second phase. Doesn't it make more sense that effective July 1, 2010, you're taking off all restrictions? You're saying, rather than trying to make it look like we're just doing phase one as a portion of these 70-some thousand kids, and then in 2010 we're going to do phase two as another portion, in effect, you're taking all restrictions off and saying everybody goes into this program.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I think that's a fair reading. That's why I said this language needs to be worked on. Because the intent is not to do, as you said, that may be the outcome. But the intent, we're going to change this language. That'll be part of the amendments that come at the next meeting. But you make a very good observation, and that's why I made the reference to the fact that this language actually needs to be worked on to accomplish what we want to do.
Fair enough. And Madam Chair, if I can, I know that other people probably have questions, but I do have three specific questions if we want to do this in the spirit of trying to work on it over the next couple of weeks. If you'll turn to Section 8 on page 3 under Application Procedures Eligibility Determination, I want to ask you a question because you know that specifically with respect to Minnesota Care and my first involvement in that over the last 2 years, eligibility from my perspective has been a big problem, how we verify eligibility. And in reading Subdivision 1 on your application procedure, Representative Thiessen, you say applications for the programs must be made available to provider offices, local human service agencies, school districts, school community health offices, and then you like open the catch-all phrase with and other sites willing to cooperate in program outreach. And not for shock value, but to give you an example, so that means any local bar, that means just about any place you want to pick. And I don't understand what you're doing with that phrase, and is that one that you're going to be working on some more?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly willing to work on it. I don't know if having an application available in a bar would, why not? You know, in some sense, I mean, if we're trying to get the applications out to people, you want to meet people where they are. You know, this is not going to be a situation where they're filling the applications out there. This is just making sure that we're getting applications out to as many people so we can interact with as many people that may be families that are eligible for this program as much as possible. I mean, coming back again to the fact that three out of every four uninsured kids in Minnesota are eligible for a public program. I mean, I think that points us to the fact that we need to do better on our outreach. Mm-hmm. And so I'm certainly, you know, and I was being a little facetious about the bar, but the point is, I'm happy to work with you if you want to narrow this in. You know, in terms of enforcement, a couple things I think I would say about that, and there may be more discussion by some of the other testifiers. First of all, eligibility is really going to be income-based now. We're not going to have as much of the four-month waiting period, but your employer's insurance, all those kind of additional eligibility factors won't be in place here. So eligibility will be simplified, which I think actually will help on the fraud and enforcement side of the equation. And income, unlike a lot of those other things, is something that we have the ability to check most easily. I mean, we have tax records in the state. You know, we have those kind of things. So we can do some cross-checking that may be more effective because we don't have as many details of eligibility.
Representative Emmer.
Madam Chair, following along that, Representative Thiessen, if you'll turn to the next page then, under renewal of eligibility, and I'm sorry, but you just gave me another question when you were talking about you think this will help fraud. And I would suggest to you that we do need to look very hard at Subdivision 4 because I don't think it will help fraud. I will submit to you that the way you've got this written, you say the commissioner shall require enrollees to renew eligibility every 12 months using, and I'll quote your words, a passive renewal process. And then you go on to say that if the eligibility information on the form is correct, they can maintain it for 12 months without returning the form to the commissioner. If the eligibility information on the form is not correct, the enrollee must return the form with corrected information. But you don't have any penalty associated with not returning a corrected form. So in reality, if the form is incorrect and there's nothing returned, then there's no way to verify that someone is eligible or should be in the program. I mean, isn't that correct based on the way it's written?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ember. I think it would be the same as if someone were submitting a new form, to be honest. I mean, the same kind of enforcement method. Again, the eligibility is going to be your income. And so you could do it in the way of you have to send back the form and say, my income is still 300% of poverty. The department would have to check that one way or another, or do spot checks, you know, however the enforcement mechanism works. Or they don't return the form, but they're going to know they're the sub, you know, they're going to do the same type of enforcement work, I would assume, because they're going to say, okay, this group of people didn't send us forms back. We ought to do some auditing, you know, like you would do an enforcement audit of certain of them. Or they say, this group of people sent their forms back and say they're still under 300% of poverty. We're going to have to do some auditing. I don't think it makes as much of a difference.
Madam Chair, that's great, because I'll take from that even though the proposal doesn't have any specific requirements or benchmarks for auditing, that it's something that you'd be open to in terms of trying to make sure that we have only people who should be on the program. My last question. In reading under this heading, Consumer Assistance, Section 11, page 5, you've got Subdivision 2 Ombudsperson. And at the risk of offending, my question is simply, are we creating a new bureaucrat, or is this a bureaucrat that already exists?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, I think it's someone new, but I can't tell you that for sure. I would imagine it's someone new. I just don't know enough about the Ombudsperson's office of whether they could, whether they could shift people around because there's fewer people who are going to be in the other programs. So it may not be a new position, but it would be a newly defined position. I mean, it may not be a new FTE.
Madam Chair, all I'd ask, and I'll leave you alone, is then can we talk about this further in terms of whether we already have people in place that can do this function?
Representative Thiessen.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, you've made several references to people being currently eligible and barriers in place, and I'm wondering for the freshmen, or for me at least, if you could just expound on that a little bit or let me know if that will happen in testimony.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it will happen in testimony. I can go over it briefly, and then in everybody's folders, there's actually a report And there's an Appendix C, I think, to the report that actually walks through a lot of these things in a little bit more detail and is a very useful place to kind of look. The areas I'm talking about, you know, the application is one. The four-month waiting period is one. So under Minnesota Care, once you lose coverage, you have to wait 4 months before you can apply and be eligible. There's the rule about 50%. So if your employer offers to pay 50% of your coverage, you don't qualify for Minnesota Care. That won't apply in this children's health care program. The thing that Representative Emmer and I were just talking about, presumptive eligibility and passive renewal. And Minnesota Care renewals every 6 months under current law. This would go to a renewal every year. Those are the types of things that I'm referring to.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I won't be long, but a few things wanted to address. Wanted to go back to Representative Broad's question about temporary. I'm assuming college students that are in school out of state would be considered part of this temporary.
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
That's a good point. I would assume that would be the case as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, the renewal of eligibility, going back to Representative Emmers, I want a model that we do have to go by is our own state health plan. As employees considering, I didn't fill out the form to renew my son when he turned 19, and he was dropped for 2 months. So we do have that model to go by. And then the last thing, I won't get into it because we do have a list of testifiers, but just wanted to make a statement as it relates to Section 9 and the service delivery, and as important as this bill is, and making sure that we get more of our children that are uninsured insured, I will have plenty of questions as it relates to expanding HMOs.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Representative Thiessen.
That's all I have. Thank you for that comment. I mean, I think that's fair.
I'm sorry. Representative Huntley?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, on the payment rates, I know that's up in the air, but currently Minnesota Care probably pays in the order of 50% of what hospitals or providers would like to charge. And health plans are probably paying them 70% of what they'd like to charge. So if you suddenly take every kid in the state and put them into a plan that's paying less than the cost to treat those kids, what's that going to do to the health care system?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, and similar, I think you're absolutely right. This is an issue. The cross-subsidy of public programs by the private programs is an issue we're going to have to deal with in the provider rate part of this. And I just don't have any more details on it than that. But, you know, with the more people that are in public programs, we're really going to have to take a more serious look at what our provider rates are.
Representative Sumter.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, in Section 9 there, again, being a freshman and new to this committee, what are community integrated service networks and what are accountable provider networks?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Schumper, you got me. I don't. No, they're a type of health plan.
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Maybe someone else who will testify there.
All right.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Randy. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Schumper.
Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, Mr. Schumper, community integrated service networks were set up as part of the earlier health right legislation, and they were intended to be sort of something like an HMO product, but something sort of an HMO that provided services on a smaller scale, and there was, I think, greater flexibility in some of the financial accountability and some of the reserve requirements. And accountable provider networks are a form of, I think these providers are paid sort of on a capitated basis, but it's a form where the providers directly are contracted with to provide services. So they're variants of the standard HMOs.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we should move on to testimony to the testifiers. I don't see any other hands. Jim Koppel from the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota. welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. We're a nonprofit advocacy organization that works on behalf of our policies in this state that will improve the lives of children. We do research, and then we come to you with recommendations for changes that will improve the lives of children in Minnesota. As I mentioned, we're a nonprofit, and we operate solely on private funding. I want to just talk briefly about the bill and our support. We're one of almost 40 organizations in a coalition supporting this legislation. This is the fourth year that it's been introduced. We've had some previous discussion. Some of you have been co-authors in the past, and we appreciate the opportunity to have additional discussion of this bill, and we think that this bill, unlike other legislation that's been or initiatives that have been talked about to date, this is the only bill that will provide health care coverage for every child in Minnesota and do it in a comprehensive way. First, I'd like to just briefly touch on the need, in addition to what Representative Thiessen talked about. Children, we often talk about preventive care and the importance of preventive care, not just for children but adults, but children are the very definition of prevention. By intervention in primary care and preventive care for children, we intervene in the unhealthy development of adults. Almost every ailment that adults have can be prevented in childhood. Chronic diseases can be treated and stabilized. And so there's so much we can do to produce healthier workers, healthier workforce, a more educated workforce, and all of this through research has been shown connected to our health care and access to health care. Also, the uncompensated care for children in Minnesota is over $70 million every year. That's just for children with no health insurance that end up in a hospital. They not only or emergency room or doctor's office, but it's not only costs that get shifted to all the rest of us who do pay our health care insurance, and those costs have to be shifted by providers to recoup it. But it's also usually the most expensive form of care. It's delayed care that ends up in a hospital or an emergency room, and it's the most expensive form of care, and oftentimes too late in the illness. The problem is, between our private system and our public system, we not only have, as a nation, one of the most expensive health care systems in the world, we have the most complicated health care system in the world. And so for children, it really depends on a national level what state you're born in, but in within each state, who your parents' employer is and how much do your parents make, as to whether or not you will have access to good health care or not. It shouldn't be that arbitrary. It will never be successful if it is that arbitrary. So we like the portion of the bill that says we're going to consolidate these programs into one program. This 20-some page application with another dozen or more pages of instructions will become a one-page application. Simple. Like almost 40 other states in this country, we'll have 12 months of coverage for children instead of 6 months. Minnesota is fourth, tied with Wisconsin, in uninsured number of uninsured children and uninsured rate. We're no longer number one. I hear a lot of that all the time, that we're such a healthy state, and we are, relatively speaking. I hate everything relatively speaking either causes, envy or conceit. So I guess we shouldn't compare ourselves, but we're not number one, and we used to be. We were for a good decade in terms of uninsured children. And the reason is states like Illinois, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Missouri, California, to name a few, have all moved toward coverage of at least 300%. New York, the governor of New York, is now pushing a bill at 500% poverty for children. The issue is we have a gap, and the big gap is between the erosion in employer-based coverage, which has continued to erode from between 2001 and 2004, there was a 7% erosion in private coverage for children. And there was a 5% increase in public programs during that time. What happens is, as private insurance erodes It leaves more and more kids in precarious positions, and they may or may not be eligible for public programs, and they have to go through this 20-some page application to figure it out. Secondly, the health care premium, since we passed Minnesota Care, many of us in this room work on Minnesota Care. Since we passed Minnesota Care, the premiums for Minnesota Care have more than doubled. And that doesn't count inflation of health care, so that, you know, the actual cost of health care has gone up. I'm talking about the percentage of your income that you have to pay for health care coverage. In 1992, when we passed it at 200% of poverty, you paid 2% of your income. Today, it's over 5%. So those increases have costed out and are listed as the number one barrier. So those eligible families that are out there, two-thirds or 75% of the eligible families that could enroll today, that don't, premiums are cited as the number one barrier in the cost of health care coverage. And we don't want children not to have health care coverage. We don't want children not to have access to health care. Everyone agrees that children should get the access to health care that they need to grow up healthy. It's just a matter of figuring out this simple way to get us there. And that's what this bill does. In as simple and affordable ways we can do it. And finally, I'd like to mention, talking about provider increases, when we look at the impact, what we tried to do in costing out this bill was to look at what it would take if we did have a significant shift of kids moving from private, under 300% of poverty, that move from private coverage into public coverage. And so you do have more kids covered. And you do, by the way, deal with the $70 million uncompensated care problem for providers when you do that. So that is an influx of money that does address some of that reimbursement. But we felt there would be a 3 to 4% increase in reimbursement rates would cover, so that the bottom line is the dollars would remain constant. The total dollars in the system would remain constant. There was about a 3 to 4% increase. And we would support an increase in reimbursement rates for providers as part of this process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a question. Are you taking questions at this point?
Sure.
Would you, Representative Norton?
Chair members, I just had a question. It seems to me we've watched our eligibility go up over the years, and I'm glad we're addressing this with the 300% as rising costs have gone up, and so we've seen more and more people slipping off insurance. But it seems to me one of the conundrums that we found ourselves in is this 300% of poverty versus 275% versus 175% on all the different programs. And the real issue is the federal definition of poverty. And I guess I'm wondering, is Children's Defense Fund as a national organization addressing this as a federal issue? Because that's really where the issue is, and we're playing around with percentages down here at the state level and across the country.
Mr. Kaplan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Norton. I think the issue is a serious one, and what, for other members not familiar with the definition of poverty, it is uniform nationwide. So if you're the definition of poverty in New York City is the same as the definition of poverty in Mississippi, and that has obviously tremendous impact in one area and then the other. Not to just pick those two areas, but urban versus rural and city versus non-city, et cetera, it's a big problem. So that's one of the reasons why we look at 300%. In most cases, a lot of people would argue that 200% of poverty in Minnesota is closer to poverty because our per capita income, our median incomes, et cetera, are very high and put us in the top 5 to 10 in the state or in the nation, and that our cost of living is much higher than the definition reflects. So it does vary. It's too bad that there aren't regional inflation. It's been a long discussed topic in Congress. I don't think anything is on the edge of happening, so it leaves states like Minnesota to address it in the best way we feel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kappel. Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Representatives. I'm Dr. Mike Severson, general pediatrician from Brainerd, Minnesota, and I've been in pediatrics for 30 years providing kids health care to rural children. I took the time to drive down here because of my strong feelings about the need to ensure all children. As a matter of fact, the logo on our stationery for the Academy of Pediatrics says just that, dedicated to the health of all children. I'm the past president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics that represents the nearly 600 pediatricians in Minnesota. And I'm currently on the board of the National American Academy of Pediatrics and represent pediatricians from the 9 Midwestern states. And I'm here to assure you how strongly pediatrics feels about providing health care to all children and providing a quality project, we are interested in providing quality care to all children. And I'd like to relate, just as you've heard some of the testimony already about the access to care. I don't have to go very back far in my thoughts, because I just have to go to yesterday. And 3 of the 40 kids I saw were self-pay. That's an uninsured child. And we, right on the corner, we try not to discriminate by how their bills are paid. But self-pay is important because we reduce their fees frequently when we see self-pay. So out of 40 kids, 3 were self-pay. These are working poor, or not even working poor, just marginally poor, hardworking people that don't have health insurance for the children, that we compromise our choices in terms of medication. Another red flag is how often I go to the sample cabinet. I'm getting asked, this takes me back to before 1992, when things got so desperate that people were asking for samples, asking for care, asking for 2-for-1s. Both kids are here, could you just charge me for 1? This is a daily dialogue in our offices now around the state, so that we are shifting care and costs. Just last week, a child who was trapped in this 4-month gap with attention deficit disorder, the school system was paying for his medication because he could no longer, the family couldn't pay for it. We have funds in our district in Brainerd to pay for the children for their medications. This shouldn't have to be in Minnesota. But worse than that is another child I saw who was in trouble for in-house suspension and behavior disorder for lack of medication because he didn't have access to the same fund. This happens on a daily basis, and I think it's important to realize how in our day-to-day working with families, how we are paying attention to these issues and how we provide care for children. The Minnesota chapter has surveyed pediatricians. We're strongly in favor of a bill such as this that would meet the health needs of all children and eliminate some of these worries that we have on a day-to-day basis. I can tell you, as a national representative, other states in the Midwest, this is a similar topic. The time is now, and I applaud you for looking at these important issues and trying to help us deal with the barriers of access and co-pays and deductibles and long application forms. The Minnesota pediatricians feel strongly about this issue. It's our only issue right now that we're talking about at meetings, and it's true outstate as well as in metro areas as well as in the inner city. I'd like to conclude my thoughts just with, you know, Minnesota provides, and I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, provide world health care. We provide health care to the world. We provide health care technology to the world. We provide health education to citizens around the world. It's time we provide for our own. It's time that we provide for our own. And I'd like you to seriously think about that we all children get insured. The hardworking people that are doing the heavy lifting and the non-glamorous jobs that are trapped between Medicare and Minnesota care and lack of health insurance I face every day. They're honorable people. They're moving from one part of their life to another. Young farmer, young businessman that's just trapped. Let's help them out of that trap. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Severson. We have a question. Could you take a question, please? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Severson, thanks so much for being here and taking time away from what I know to be a very important job that you're doing. So thanks so much. One of the questions that I have, though, is the concerns I hear from physicians of varying specialties is government dictating what they do in their exam rooms and government dictating too much and getting their hands too much involved in what happens between them and their patients. If government is more and more involved in paying for whatever service you're providing or paying for whatever it is that you need to do for that child, for that family, are you concerned or is your organization concerned at all about, or maybe to what level is your organization concerned about government interference and government fingers on what you're doing in your job?
I don't think that we, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, being the rules, Madam Chair, I don't think that we attach the reimbursement with government involvement. We recognize that quality products take quality control and that we work by the rules and we work with the health department currently to provide good quality care and represent that. Yet my colleagues certainly would want me to pay attention to the fiscal load and the reimbursement that we get, but we would much prefer a transparent system that doesn't force us to discriminate as we see children and care for them and prescribe for them. Thank you.
For that note.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Severson, to that note, do you think the government will tie your hands any more than the insurance companies?
Dr. Severson.
Just curious.
Madam Chair.
So thank you again for coming.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brian Rushi. I'm Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition and represent the consensus agenda of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. And this is one of our top priorities this year, passage of the Children's Health Security Act. Representative Thiessen, at the beginning of his remarks, said that there was a moral imperative to act to cover all kids, and we certainly agree with that. Let me unpack just a little bit of what I view to be that moral imperative. One of the things that holds Catholics and Protestants and Jews and Muslims together is this idea of human dignity, that every person has unassailable human dignity. And in a sense, that means that we as a community have to do everything we can to safeguard that dignity. And I know all of us in this room, every single one of us, realizes that health care is one of those things that safeguards human dignity. It gives people a chance to have a fulfilling and healthy and prosperous life. And we should do what we can, especially for those that are vulnerable. And kids are at our mercy. I mean, we have to raise up the next generation of our community and make sure that they're healthy and get off to a good start. So that moral imperative is clear, just to protect human dignity and to be there for people with their health care needs. But there's another aspect to this moral imperative too, and that's to be good stewards of our resources. One of the most profound criticisms I think we all have of the health care system is that we're squandering hundreds of millions of dollars and not getting good health care outcomes for that. And this system is riddled with barriers and complexity and misunderstandings, and people aren't using the health care system wisely, nor are we setting it up to be used wisely. And I think that's what this bill is really all about, to make things simple and easy to understand so every parent, every caretaker knows that their child can get the health care that they need when it's most appropriate. Delayed care is expensive care. It's foolish. It costs us all in the long run not to make it very clear and understandable what you need to do if your child has a health care need. So we certainly agree there's a moral imperative to act. I would observe in talking to congregations and social concerns committees over the last couple of years about this bill that people are really hungry for a solution, to take a bold step and to say the healthcare system is broken, because the people realize that. They realize it every day. Getting costed out of insurance, whether you're an employee or an employer, or dealing with deductibles and copays that are maddening. Not being able to understand financially what's going on when the bills arrive at your house. Everyone knows it's broken. The ambiguity out there that I sense is, where do you hold on? Where are the handholds to address this problem? One of the things that enjoys broad support across the state, age group, denomination, faith tradition, race, and income, is that the least we should do is to ensure all kids. It's a great starting point. There's amazing political consensus, in my opinion, that we should ensure all kids. It's the handhold to the broken system. Let's make sure all the kids are in. And then let's be thoughtful about how we construct that system so maybe it will have some important learnings for how we move to comprehensive care for everyone. But at the minimum, let's start with kids. Let's remove the barriers, make it affordable, make it simple, make it understandable, and make wise choices about putting our health care dollars where they have the longest term benefits. That's the wisdom that I think our religious traditions have to offer in this debate. Wisdom that's been amassed over quite a few years. Again, let me just stress, I think the political will is there. The people in some senses are ahead of us who do policy work. They want us to move forward and to be bold and to do the right thing and ensure all kids. Thanks for the opportunity, Madam Chair, to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming. All right, we have a half hour left of testimony, so we'll continue on here. Welcome to the committee. State your name, please, for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Denise Herman. I am with the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. I have been a pediatric nurse practitioner and a licensed school nurse for over 19 years. This is our number one issue across the state in terms of getting health care coverage for kids. Every day there is a nurse in this state who hears the statement, if you think, then I will take my child to the doctor, despite not having insurance or despite having to pay a high copay. Every day a nurse in this state is looking to their community, who can I send this child to that perhaps would give free or reduced care? It happens every day. I was not in school nursing more than 2 years when I had a parent come to me. Well, his child had fallen the night before, had an obvious broken arm, no health insurance. If you think it's broken, then I will take them to the doctor. So this is a huge issue for our children across the state and the school nurses. Kids have acute illnesses, ear infections, eye infections, skin infections, and then all of our kids with chronic health conditions. 12% of the kids that sit in a classroom might have asthma. Another 10% have mental health, and another 1% have diabetes. And if you lost your health insurance and you have to wait 4 months to get your insulin, to get your controller medication, in the meantime, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the emergency room, and you're going to get your care there because those kinds of conditions do not wait for the insurance eligibility. Health and education are linked. Again, we see it every day. Healthy kids learn better. It's an old cliche, but it is very, very true. Our kids cannot put their health condition at the door when they walk into school. They're walking in with everything. I have four stories that are from my practice and from some of my peers. We just put out an all call because we said, we hope that we get a chance to tell the story of kids in Minnesota. Send me your stories. And these are the stories. One is a student who needed immunizations to be in compliance with the school immunization law. The parent presented her Minnesota MA card. She was not currently enrolled. She had moved 3 times in the last 3 months, and that somehow or another that 6-month renewal letter didn't catch up to her. A student with asthma. This is a family that has 2 children with asthma. Asthma is treated with 2 kinds of medications, controller medications that take care of the inside swelling and mucus, and rescue medications, which take care of the muscles on the outside. The rescue medication comes as a generic medication. The controller medications are all none of them come as generic. 2 kids, 2 medications, $100 a month copay. In the meantime, the student is missing school, and this family cannot afford that $100 a month to pay the co-pays for those controller medications. They will rely on the rescue medicines, which means that child is missing more school and is having to receive more emergency and urgent care. I got an email from a parent
help. I'm wondering if you can help me find a free clinic. I am completely out of options on getting him insurance. He is missing an incredible amount of school because he has been sick. I just don't have the money. I am working 3 jobs now to afford his insulin. This is a student with diabetes whose parent is private paying for insulin, the little sticky things, in order to keep her child well. And the last one is a student who is in our ALC, trying to graduate, has a mental health condition, needs 4 medications for the mental health condition, and 1 medication each month, a refill. So that's $125 a month for medication. It is going to be way more expensive for us as a society if this child doesn't graduate. But her mental health condition and her asthma will keep her from getting there, or getting there timely, because they can't afford it. And there are no options for this child. You know, the insurance programs through any of the pharmaceuticals are for it who have no insurance. So all you could do is go back and hopefully find a Dr. Severson that maybe has a sample catalog or can find a cheaper med maybe that will do the care, one that would maybe be a generic. All of these kids need your help. And I am so glad that you're all here and you are entering this debate. These kids cannot learn. They will not be successful. They need your help. Their parents need your help. All of these are parents who are working very, very hard every day and trying to make the best choices that they can. But the barriers, and they've talked about them, the 4 months and not having presumptive eligibility, that long darn form, trying to fill that out, all of those kinds of things keep the kids that could be eligible from even getting there. So I, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here and just say that school nurses want to see every kid in Minnesota have the right to health care just like they can do to go to school. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I have a question. One moment, please. She has a question.
Oh.
Sorry about that.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ms. Herman, first of all, I just want to say that I really appreciate your testimony, and obviously you bring a lot of passion to this, and you know, as a mother sitting here listening, you know, I can think of fewer things that would be more wrenching than having your child really need care and not being able to afford it. I mean, that is really, when you really think about that, that's a pretty terrible thing that no one should experience. But what I wanted to ask you is, as a school nurse, you know, when I think about, I kind of try to imagine how this might play out if this bill were to pass, and frankly, for me, this is a top priority for me in this session. I think if we accomplish this this session, it would just be a wonderful thing. But as I think about how it might play out, I wonder whether we have capacity in our system, whether there are things that, you know, if we were to cover every child in Minnesota, whether there are ways that you might be thinking of as a school nurse that... or as a nurse practitioner, you know, whether there are pieces of ways that we might deliver care to children that would be more efficient than the way we currently do it. You know, for example, you know, people might think of giving immunizations in the school setting, we do certain kinds of screenings in the school setting. Are there things that you've thought about that, I know it's a little bit off the actual topic of this bill, but I think it's related because we've got to talk about costs in all of this and how we might deliver the services. And I just wonder if you've given any thought to that, whether there's capacity right now, if suddenly everybody who needs the care can go and get it, or if there are ways that you'd like to see things delivered that you think might work a little better.
Ms. Herman.
Representative, Madam Chair, thank you. I have thought about this often in terms of that. I think that we could certainly build the capacity. I think that there's any number of ways to do that. I'd have to be the first to say, though, we can't build capacity on the back of K-12 funding, and because there isn't enough funding there for that either. So in lieu of that, you know, I think there are some other ways to deliver health care for kids. I think that whether we all like it or not, there is always a segment of the population that will want to get their care in a more non-traditional fashion, who want to be able to walk in and be seen and can't make an appointment and keep it, but need to still have the ability to walk in somewhere and get that appointment. And there are many healthcare providers and organizations who I think are very well aware of that and could easily come up with some different and alternative methods for getting that kind of care done. So I think we do have that capacity. I think we could rev up pretty darn fast. I think that I know that in many, many school nurses, if we're already calling every clinic, making appointments for families, we're trying to help them through that 20-page application. So we're already doing a lot of the work anyway. It's just a very cumbersome system and very difficult. The system, if they had insurance, that's one whole block that would get us there faster.
Once again, thank you, Ms. Herman.
Thank you
for your testimony. And we have about a half hour. A few more testifiers. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Javier Murillo Alicea, not Kristen Beckman. On the list. I am with the Service Employees International Union. I'm president of SEIU Local 26. Local 26 represents over 5,000 low-wage property service workers in the seven-county metro area. And like many families in our STAR members, see the healthcare crisis directly every day. Of our 4,200 members, half have access to care at all. A quarter take it. Those who don't take it tell us overwhelmingly they don't because of costs. And of 4,200 janitors who clean the skyways, the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, all our commercial real estate, who keep the Twin Cities beautiful, 4,200, 14 of them, that's not a percentage, 14 have family health insurance through their employer. This is an important enough crisis for our membership that just last Saturday we voted to authorize a strike on this issue. We've been in negotiations with our employer, and those talks broke down when our employer told us they would not talk to us any further until we took our proposal for family health insurance off the table. So if we look at just recent labor disputes, not just here but just in the country, healthcare is just such a prime issue. For me, this is about someone like a young mother named Lucrecia, who's a member of ours. She works in a very expensive office building in Minnetonka. She has a daughter who has a stomach condition. Every time she goes to the doctor, she has paid up to $600 for a doctor visit. She needs an endoscopy to be diagnosed, and she just can't afford it. And so her daughter is getting sicker and undiagnosed. Or another member named Mercedes, who works at she cleans the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. She's a janitor there who works on the first shift, and she has a daughter with a respiratory illness, and she simply can't afford to have the regular care that she needs. And I see this day in and day out, people who put off care and then eventually end up in an emergency room where it is much more expensive. So I feel very strongly, our union feels very strongly, that it's time for dramatic action on the healthcare crisis we face. It's just not good enough to cover a couple of kids and call it a day. And that's why we're here in support. So,
thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We have a question from Representative Broad. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, does your organization support a single-payer government-run system in full?
What our organization supports is universal health care. How we get to that, I think, what we're looking to are solutions. The long-term goal has to be universal coverage. What form that takes, I think, is, as long as it happens, I'm happy.
Representative Fraud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just if I'm understanding you correctly, just for argument's sake, if we were able to put forward something in the private market that provided coverage for everybody, your organization would support that?
I guess the how I'd answer that is right now the private market. That's exactly what our labor dispute is at the moment. It's trying to get more families covered within the context of a private system. If not the private system, unfortunately, is just not working very well, and everything we do are band-aids.
Representative Brad, does that answer your question? All right. Any other questions?
Yes. Madam Chair, just for the record, no, it did not. But I think we're ready to move on.
All right. Thank you. And thank you to the testifier as well. We'll move on to the next testifier, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name for the tape, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George. I'm the Government Affairs Staff Specialist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. The MNA is the largest professional organization in the Midwest for nurses, and we represent approximately 20,000 registered nurses statewide. We appreciate the opportunity to testify and would like to thank both Representative Paul Thiessen and the Children's Defense Fund for bringing forward House File 1. The Nurses Association has long believed that everyone deserves a right to affordable, quality health care, and we think it's critical that children have access to needed immunizations and well baby child care so that they can have a healthy start and live up to their full functioning. We believe this bill is a critical step forward, but of course we think we need to do more because we believe that healthcare is a crisis both politically, socially, and economically for many individuals and families in our state. Too often we hear from nurses every day in the acute care setting talking about children who come to them with serious conditions and complications that could have been avoided with early coverage, and I think you heard a lot of that from Denise and the other testifiers today. Just generally, there are a number of provisions that line up with nurses' vision for health care reform that are in this bill. One is the streamlining of the public programs and the simplification of the enrollment process, including the requirement that the applications be provided in a number of community locations. To Representative Liebling's point about delivering health care in other settings, we think that should happen too, not only the application process, but we need to look broader in terms of where we deliver care. We like the delinking of health care coverage from employment. Health care coverage for children should not be tied to where parents work, and unfortunately, many families cannot afford the dependent care coverage through their work. We also support the elimination of the financial insurance and the insurance barriers that you heard about today that are both in the public programs, and as well as the access to comprehensive benefits and the requirement for the evaluation of both quality and costs in the program. Unfortunately, despite our high spending in health care and our status as one of the healthiest states, we continue to see that our minority populations are experiencing poorer health outcomes than our other rest of our population. So we recognize that the bill does focus on addressing a number of the health disparities that we have in our state, but we think it's also going to be important to evaluate the current models of delivery that we have now to make sure that we do have better outcomes. Finally, I'd like to say we are supportive of the task force that will look at broader reforms, including ways to contain costs on our health care system, with its emphasis on prevention and quality. Again, nurses' vision calls for a wholesale restructuring of our health care system that will look at quality as a way to improve outcomes and reduce costs, and as well as to shift our current emphasis on our system today that is based on illness and care to one of prevention and care. Our only suggestion would be that you might add looking at covering everyone after we look at the study around children, because we know that children do better in families that are healthy as well. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Smith, and I'm the Director of Policy for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on House File 1. I also want to thank Representative Paul Thiessen and the members of the committee for holding this hearing today. Let me just provide you with a little bit of background. There are a lot of new members around the table, and folks who aren't familiar with all the different organizations they're going to be hearing from this year. Minnesota Council of Health Plans is a trade association representing 8 nonprofit health plans. The council promotes the delivery of high-quality, affordable health care. Our health plan members are active in areas of health care reform, research-based guidelines development, community health and prevention, medical technology assessment, and health care quality data collections. Our members employ nearly 16,000 Minnesotans and are located in communities around the state. As nonprofit organizations, our members are recognized throughout the country for their collaborative efforts to improve the health care of their members. Most recently, the health plans, in collaboration with the Minnesota Medical Association, launched Minnesota Community Measurement. Minnesota's health plans are dedicated to strengthening Minnesota's rank as the healthiest state in the nation. Together with community partners, our health plans both lead and support efforts to increase the value of health care services. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans believes that all Minnesotans should have health care coverage. We are pleased with all of the attention lawmakers are directing this session toward increasing the number of children covered in Minnesota. I'm going to make a few comments, specific comments about House File 1. Under Section 5 eligibility, we support the goal of this legislation and support the language to provide coverage for kids up to 300% of the federal poverty guidelines. We have some concerns about the effect that carving children out of the existing risk pool will have on premiums in the commercial market. As a group, children tend to be a healthier, lower-cost population, and therefore their inclusion in the commercial pool helps to spread costs over a larger number of people. However, we believe it is possible to extend coverage to all children without creating unintended consequences to the rest of the market. Section 12 deals with monitoring and evaluation of quality and cost. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans supports monitoring and evaluating quality and cost. In fact, Minnesota's health plans are required already to submit more than 200 reports annually to DHS, to the Department of Health, to Commerce, and other state agencies. These reports contain detailed information on spending, quality, utilization, customer service, and more. So rather than creating additional reporting requirements, we would respectfully ask the author and others working with this bill to explore a review of existing reporting requirements and then build off of that to enhance the information about quality improvement. Just generally, regarding the language on outreach, this has come up a couple of times in the testimony, and I just wanted to make sure people were aware of some of the great information we get from the Department of Health. But the specific data is located in this report called Health Insurance Coverage in Minnesota Trends from 2001 to 2004. And on page 68 of this report is where it does address that 78% of children eligible are uninsured. And so it's actually, you know, we've been throwing around numbers like 60%, I've heard 70%. It's actually closer to 80% of all the eligible kids, of all kids who are uninsured, are already eligible for programs. And so I would encourage people to download this from the Department of Health website. It's a great report. Putting a greater emphasis on outreach could help a great deal to reduce the number of insured. If funding becomes available for outreach efforts, we would encourage the legislature to direct those funds toward those outreach programs that have been proven to work. And we have some experience with that. Would be happy to share more with committee members and the author on some of our ideas. I also just want to mention briefly, and it's been mentioned earlier, about encourage making the application form for public programs more user-friendly. The current application process is very lengthy and actually does serve as a barrier for people. And so people have been talking about it, and I was thinking, well, how long is that application? So I printed it out before I came here. This is how big it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is a total of 36 pages. It's a 24-page application with 8 pages of instructions. So I just want people to be aware of that it really does exist. And, you know, I'll just leave it here, and people can take a look at it or pass it around if they like. Just in summary, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans strongly supports the goal of this legislation to expand coverage to all children. We believe that when people have coverage, they're more likely to seek earlier intervention and treatment, resulting in better health, all the while using resources in a more cost-effective manner. So thank you very much for this opportunity to comment. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes. I have a question from Representative Liebling.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the concern about the effect on the rates for commercial insurance if we took kids out of the pool. And I was wondering if you had any figures on how many children are actually covered in the commercial pool, and in particular, how many are covered who are under 300% of poverty. Ms. Kmet.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I don't have information with me right away, but I will get that information back to you.
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, we can talk as well. I have some of that information from the department that may be helpful to people.
Okay. Again, thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
State
My name,
name
is John T. Garland. I'm an endocrinologist who returned to the Midwest to enjoy our retirement years in a forward-looking state. Today I speak on behalf of the Minnesota Universal Healthcare Coalition, which represents 13 organizations dedicated to achieving a Medicare for All healthcare system. We wholeheartedly endorse the intent of House File 1 to extend coverage to all children, but the sections which require participating children to be in private plans will raise costs, reduce choice, and may jeopardize quality. The coalition would like to work with you to amend that aspect of the bill. House File 1 will raise total costs by as much as 25% by inserting a middleman, the private health plan companies, between the funding source and the doctors, hospitals, and other providers who will treat enrollees. We urge you to amend this bill to permit DHS to reimburse providers directly. This is nothing new. In fact, Minnesota's largest employers do just that. The bill refers repeatedly to contracts with health plan companies, but no section of the bill refers to contracts with health care providers. The three types of health plan companies described in Section 9 are HMOs, Community Integrated Service Networks, and Accountable Provider Networks. According to the Minnesota Department of Health website, there are no Community Integrated Service Networks or Accountable Provider Networks now in existence. I refer you now to the attachments that you received with a copy of this testimony. Attachment A compares what happens to a tax dollar in a direct purchasing program without a private middleman with what happens to that dollar in a program similar to that proposed by House File 1. The program with the middleman costs 20% more for what are essentially administrative costs. Thus, less money remains for health care compared with the direct payment plan. Attachment B shows the evidence that direct purchasing saves money in Medicare, in other states' Medicaid programs, and in the private sector. The most powerful evidence comes from a group of Fortune 500 companies here in Minnesota known as the Buyers Health Care Action Group. In 1993, they decided to bypass HMOs and self-insure their employees. 5 years later, they announced that by self-insuring, by cutting out the HMO middleman, they cut their insurance costs by 11%. The HMOs in Minnesota claim their overhead is 10%, not 20%, but as the Citizens League pointed out, HMOs sometimes understate overhead costs. For example, HMOs may consider a nurse utilization reviewer to be a provider of health care. Medica considers a portion of its management contract with United Healthcare to be the equivalent of Medicare, of medical care. The coalition firmly believes that the direct purchasing, publicly financed health care model provides a better statewide health outcome for all populations at lower cost than individual health plan companies can provide. Private plans also were initially promoted as means to improve quality. That assumption has not been demonstrated, and in fact there is some evidence from the 1990s that quality suffered in some managed care programs. Please see attachment C. We're very happy that this committee is debating a bill to extend coverage to so many more Minnesotans. On November 14, 2006, Governor Pawlenty raised the question about the role of HMOs, now that we have experimented with them for many years. He said, and I quote, "The role of the HMOs is called into question. Are they just banks? Are they just underwriters of risk? Are they true partners? What is the health value of what they do? If they are just glorified aggregators of risk that don't meaningfully improve health, we need to chart a different future." We agree with the governor on this point and hope that he still supports that scrutiny, long overdue, in our view. We look forward to working with you to make this landmark bill the best combination of fiscal responsibility, expanded coverage, and quality health outcomes for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jumper.
Madam Chair, Dr. Garland, it's my understanding that the Department of Health, Human Services at one time did directly purchase health care. Are you familiar with that?
I think in the past they had.
I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
I'm sorry. No.
Madam Chairman, I think in the past they had before the privatization of the state plans. And as I understand it, initially there was to be a demonstration that the privatization would improve the quality of care, but we've done a lot of research trying to find out whether those studies were actually done, and we've not been able to have anybody produce the data, so it appears that it was slid by and that they did not do the studies comparing the privatized counties with the ones that were privatized later. And they just went ahead and privatized them all later.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to, my understanding of this 25% increase in cost is not this program versus current program, but this program versus eliminating a middleman.
Yes. Okay.
Right. Thank you for your clarification. Thank you for your testimony, Doctor.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I'm a teacher in St. Paul. I'm currently president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today to talk about health care for children, House File 1, and I would like you to consider, as you debate this, to consider it health care for students as well, and that's, I'm here in that capacity, and I can't begin to repeat with the eloquence that my colleague Ms. Herman started with the Minnesota School Nurses Association, but I can speak from a teacher's point of view that the working conditions of a teacher are directly tied to the health of our students and the working conditions of our students. And our students are always willing to give 100%. They are willing to be engaged in their learning as long as they don't have barriers to that learning. And often, teachers see that barrier to learning for a student being their health care, being a chronic condition, be it a one-time incident, be it some catastrophe that puts their family precariously on the edge of bankruptcy because of a medical emergency. And then that ends up cascading into a transience with our students in that if a family needs to find a more affordable place to live because of the precarious situation of their health care and the cost of their health care, they're moving from school to school. Often they're moving in different to one community to another community. Our students are also home more often. Sometimes it's absenteeism because of that health care condition, and sometimes it's truancy because of that chronic health care condition and because of the embarrassment of not being able to treat it oftentimes, or because they're home caring for a sick sibling or a sick family member. So please understand that this is an educational issue for our students. The power of a teacher to make a difference is mitigated by the lack of access to health care many of our students have. And so I would appreciate if you would take that into consideration as you debate this, and I wholeheartedly support covering students in the state of Minnesota so that we can have more power in our classrooms with them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And would you take a question, please, Representative Abler?
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Ricker. Thanks for coming along.
Sure.
I presume you're talking more in the global sense about the high aspirations it still has, which are very good aspirations. Are you familiar with the proposal for the statewide teacher health insurance proposal?
Very familiar with it, yeah.
And Ms. Ricker, does your group support that?
The State Ball Federation of Teachers? Yes, we do. We've supported it for the last 3 years as a solidarity issue to the districts that no longer provide coverage for any of their school employees.
Sure, I respect that. Just want to caution you, as you embrace this particular proposal, which would take out some of the kids, you would mess up the pooling effect, which was one of the big hallmarks of that proposal. So, and just
I don't think so.
Well,
we're
just
talking about
the
pools, but.
Representative, finish your question.
Yeah, and I respect the chair of this committee for his work on this proposal, and there's many tie-ins to other proposals, and I commend him for making this his first bill to come out with, and there's with the teacher's proposal and the other ones that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do something, and this is a good start, so thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're out of time.
Yes.
So just kind of to finish this bill, just a little...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I have a comment, I guess. You know, going around during the campaign, everybody was talking about skyrocketing health care costs, and that's one of the reasons why I requested this committee. And you listen to the testimony back home, you listen to the testimony here, and they talk about the erosion of employee-based coverage, that people can't afford or secure health care insurance. Minnesota care premiums or government premiums are the number one barrier as far as securing health care. There's ongoing issues about access, co-pays, deductibles, and then people get furious that they can't afford health sharing, health care coverage, but yet you hear about CEO pays and golden parachutes and what's commonly referred to as legalized theft, if you will. But everybody knows that the system is broken. Everybody acknowledges that the system is broken. But it's absolutely maddening that people think the only solution is government, more government. And Representative Thiessen, you mentioned in your opening statement that small employers are dropping coverage because they can't afford it or secure it, and that's the 800-pound gorilla that's sitting in the middle of the room. And again, it's maddening that government is the only solution. And so I guess my point is this. If you're coming down here to testify against this bill, then you darn well better bring forth solutions and alternatives, because I want to hear them. And if you want to talk to me in private, I'm in room 215. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Representative Hamilton, what would be your solution for this situation?
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair and Representative Tao, you know, there's people that are a lot smarter than I am sitting in this room, and that's why I'm bringing up this challenge. I want people to come to me and talk to me about what their solutions are, and I'll make an educated decision at that point in time.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And Representative Thiessen, are we ready to lay this over?
Yes.
The table? All right. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.